Welcome to Torati Mecha Nach Yomi with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Rachel Kosowski, and today we will be studying Megillat Esther, Perek Gimel, Chapter 3. Yesterday, we discussed an idea of Chazal, our sages, of Rifu'ah Lufnei HaMakah, Hashem providing the solution to a situation which is ready and waiting before the problem arises. The events of the previous chapter, Perek Bet, Chapter 2, Esther being chosen as the Queen of Persia, and Mordechai foiling an assassination plot against Ahasuerus are the refuah, the antidote, for the diabolical plot of Haman, whom we meet in today's chapter. The first words of Perek Gimel, Chapter 3, are, Achar hadvarim ha'ela, after these things. And Rashi explains these things are referring to Hashem having created the refuah, the potential for salvation. The verse continues by indicating that Ahasuerus raised the stature of Haman ben Hamdata Agagi, Haman the son of Hamdata the Agagite, above all other officers. The next verse tells us that the king had commanded everyone in the king's court to kneel and bow to Haman, and all complied with the exception of Mordechai. When I was a child learning this story, I imagined a line of people bowing to the ground while Mordechai conspicuously stood up, refusing to bow. A close reading of the text, however, reveals that initially Haman doesn't notice that Mordechai is not bowing to him. It seems like Mordechai was subtly avoiding bowing to Haman because it is not Haman, but the other Abdei HaMelech, the king's courtiers, who confront Mordechai about this refusal to bow. It is not immediately obvious why Mordechai won't bow to Haman. There are countless examples of people from Bnei Israel, from our nation, bowing to others. Our patriarch Abraham, Avram Avinu, in Breishit Perek Yudchet Pasuk Bet, chapter 18, verse 2, bows to three men who, although they turn out to be angels, appear to be regular travelers. When Yosef's brothers first meet Yosef in his role as the Egyptian viceroy, in Breishit Membet Vav, chapter 42, verse 6, his brothers do not recognize him and bow to him thinking he's an Egyptian official. Rashi and Ibn Ezra, back in Megillat Esther, cite different approaches of our sages to explain Mordechai's refusal to bow. Ibn Ezra suggests that Haman was wearing an idol on his clothing or turban. Rashi says that he made himself a god. These explanations highlight the idea that there was something about Haman which is antithetical to Hashem. If we note how Haman is introduced to us in the Megillah and how Mordechai is introduced, which we saw yesterday, we can deepen our understanding of this conflict. Haman is introduced to us as Ha'agagi, the Agagite. Mordechai is introduced with a line of his ancestors going back to Kish. This brings to mind the battle centuries earlier between Shaul ben Kish, the first king of Israel, against Amalek and their king Agag. Amalek is the nation which first attacked the people of Israel from behind on their journey after leaving Egypt. After that battle, Hashem declares an eternal war with Amalek. The nation of Amalek represents the opposite of what the Torah demands of us. Amalek preys on the weak. The Torah teaches us to care for the disadvantaged in our society. By referring to Haman as the Agagi and Mordechai as Ben Kish, the Megillah paints the conflict between Mordechai and Haman as part of an age-old clash, not just between the people of Israel and Amalek, but between Hashem and Amalek. Bowing to Amalek is the equivalent of bowing to an idol, and it is a line Mordechai won't cross. When Ahasuerus' courtiers notice Mordechai's behavior, they continually pester Mordechai on a daily basis about his choice. Pasuk Dalet, verse 4, tells us, Vayhi bamram elav yom vayom velo shama alehem. And it was when they said to him day after day, and he did not listen to them. I had a wonderful Tanakh teacher in 11th grade who at the time was Ms. Rena Gopin, subsequently Mrs. Rena Wolf. She taught our class the literary parallel between this line and a line from the Yosef story as one of many ideas and approaches to Megillat Esther, which I have incorporated into my own teaching. Back in Breishit, Perek Lamed Tet, chapter 39, Yosef is being seduced by his master Potiphar's wife. Pasuk Yud, verse 10, tells us, Vayhi kedabra al Yosef yom yom velo shamayla lishkavetzla liotima. And it was when she spoke to Yosef day after day and he did not listen to her to lie by her side to be with her. Both lines involve being nagged on a daily basis and refusing to give in. It seems like the author of the Megillah is intentionally echoing the Yosef story with this line. There are many parallels between the story of Yosef and the story of Mordechai and Esther. Both involve Jews rising to power in a foreign court. In that situation, both Yosef and Mordechai had to choose when they went along with the culture and society in which they found themselves and where they drew the line. Egyptian culture was known for its sexual immorality. That is where Yosef drew the line, refusing what might have been an opportunity to sleep his way to the top. The Megillah paints Mordechai's refusal to bow to Haman as taking a similar moral stand. Bowing to Amalek would be a complete betrayal of his values. Seeing that talking to Mordechai is not working, Ahasuerus' courtiers decide to tell Haman that Mordechai is not bowing to him. Perhaps as a pun, Pasuk Daled, verse 4, indicates that they wanted to see Haya'amdu divrei Mordechai. Would Mordechai's words stand? And then continues, Ki gid lahem asher hu Yehudi, for he had told them that he was a Jew. This could be giving the reason why Mordechai wouldn't bow, or the reason they told on him, motivated by anti-Semitism. We can imagine them thinking, who does this Jew think he is, not bowing to Haman? It is only after the king's courtiers tell Haman that Mordechai is not bowing that Haman notices it, and at that point is filled with rage. It is then that we see something we have seen countless times throughout Jewish history. All Jews are blamed for the actions of one. It is not enough for Haman to vent his anger on Mordechai. He decides to destroy all Jews. Interestingly, Haman decides to rely on a lottery called a Pur, and the source for the name of the holiday Purim, to choose what day to destroy the Jews. Although the lot is drawn during Nisan, it indicates the month of Adar 11 months later, which will give the Jews time to contend with this threat. Then Haman decides to present his plan to King Ahasuerus, which he does in a veiled manner. Haman describes an unnamed nation spread throughout the provinces of Ahasuerus' kingdom. Haman indicates that they have different laws from all other nations and accuses them of not following the king's laws. Haman then says, "V'lamelech ein shoveh lahanicham." It is not worth it for the king to leave them be. Haman suggests issuing an edict to destroy them and offers a bribe of 10,000 silver talents to be added to the king's treasury. Amos Chacham points out in the Dat Mikra commentary how familiar this speech of Haman is, so typical of the approach of anti-Semites throughout the generations, with half-baked truths, lack of context, and omission of the personal details, in this case, Haman's vendetta against Mordechai. Time and time again, our enemies malign us in a way which seems plausible to others and incites hatred against us. King Ahasuerus immediately acquiesces to Haman's suggestion. He hands over his signet ring used for sealing edicts, refuses the bribe, and says Haman can do as he pleases to this nation. It's interesting that Ahasuerus never inquires who this nation is. There is no follow-up, no investigation before condemning an entire population to genocide. If he doesn't know who Haman is talking about, he seems remarkably uncurious given the gravity of the decision he is making. Perhaps he knows exactly who Haman is talking about, and this is one of those wink-wink, nod-nod types of conversations with a clear subtext not officially stated. This ambiguity is reminiscent of the machloket between our sages, Rav and Shmuel, which we discussed when learning Perek Aleph, Chapter 1, as to whether Ahasuerus was pikeach or tipesh, shrewd or foolish. Is Ahasuerus easily swayed by his advisors, first Memuchan, now Haman, who perhaps were one and the same given the similar approaches used in convincing Ahasuerus to issue new laws? Or is Ahasuerus in on the anti-Semitism, just as eager as Haman to eliminate the Jews and giving himself plausible deniability by never actually saying or having Haman say outright who the victims of Haman's plot are? The Megillah leaves this for us to decide. The Megillah continues with very specific language describing the issuing of the decree against the Jews, with the scribes being summoned on the 13th of Nisan, mentioning the different officials who will receive the edict, how it will be written in the various languages of the different nations and the different provinces, and the process of how this proclamation was disseminated. We will see similar language towards the end of the Megillah and discuss the significance of the parallel at that time. Pasuk Yud Gimel, verse 13, tells us that the edict was Lahashmid, Laharog, Ulabed at Kol HaYehudim, Minar V'Yad Zakein, Taf V'Nashim, B'Yom Echad, B'Shloshasar, L'Chodesh Neimasar, Huchodesh Adar, Ushlalam Lavoz. To destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews, from young to old, women and children, in one day on the 13th of the 12th month, the month of Adar, and to seize their plunder. I would say that the horror of this edict is unimaginable, except that unfortunately it is not only imaginable to us, but something we have seen again and again throughout our history, and unbelievably again just over 2 years ago. The chapter ends with the king and Haman sitting down to drink, literally drinking to the death of the Jews, followed by saying, "V'ha'ir Shushan Navocha," and the city of Shushan was bewildered. This private party of Haman and Ahasuerus is the fifth of 10 parties in the Megillah. These first five parties are all celebrations by the Persians, culminating in celebrating the destruction of the Jews. We will see, beginning with tomorrow's Perek, chapter 5, that this tide will turn. Rashi understands Va'ir Shushan Navocha as referring to the Jews of Shushan being bewildered. Alshich suggests that the Jews themselves had not seen the edict, but feared the worst. Zat Mikra points out that the verse indicates Ha'ir Shushan, as opposed to Shushan Habira, referring to the residents outside the palace, and suggests that this edict was bewildering to non-Jews as well. One can imagine being commanded to get up one day and kill their neighbors in cold blood might be confusing. Perek Gimel introduces us to Haman, who seemingly comes out of nowhere, rises to power, and uses the conflict with Mordechai as a pretense to convince Ahasuerus, who doesn't need much convincing, to annihilate the Jewish people. The bewilderment which ensues is all too familiar and painful to us, and sets the stage for the response of Mordechai and Esther, which we will see in tomorrow's Perek, chapter 4. Thank you for studying together in the memory of our beloved father and grandfather, Ted Ordin, Mordechai ben Ephraim v'Miriam Golda, in commemoration of his 10th Yortzeit. His family is forever grateful for his devotion to family, vision, courage, and optimism. May the merit of our collective learning elevate his neshama and bring unity and peace to Klal Yisrael, Helen and Moshe Sassover and family.